Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Appreciate you tuning in. Got a good one for you today. But before we get to it, another shout-out needs to be shouted out to one of my new NewsHound-tiered patrons on Patreon.com. Thank you, Maggie Poffenbarger from California, for your support at Patreon.com/MostNotorious. And a big thank you always to all of my patrons. I appreciate you so much. Remember, if you like the idea of ad-free episodes on both Most Notorious and Minnesota's Most Notorious, you can find them there along with other cool stuff. All right, let's get to the interview. So glad to have as my guest today Larry Wood. He is the prolific author of 15 nonfiction history books, 2 historical novels, and over 400 magazine stories and articles. His The Two Civil War Battles of Newtonia won the Walter Williams Award in 2011. He is here to talk about his most recent release, a book called Bigamy and Bloodshed, The Scandal of Emma Molloy and the Murder of Sarah Graham. So great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me.
So this was a story that was pretty sensational during its time, but it is not necessarily all that well known now. How did you first hear about it, and what led you to write a book about it?
I first heard about it, I think, right around the year 2000. I was just kind of perusing a Greene County, Missouri history from 1915, and it described the preliminary hearing of the 2 women involved in the case as the most, not the most sensational, but the most spectacular legal proceeding in the entire history of the county. And that just kind of struck me as, you know, this must be an interesting case. So the more I started researching it, the more I kind of agreed that it was a spectacular case. And I ended up writing a magazine article for the now defunct Ozarks Mountaineer. And then also ended up including a chapter about this case in a couple of books. There are one called Ozarks Gunfights and Other Notorious Incidents, and one called Wicked Joplin about the city, or not Wicked Joplin, Wicked Springfield. I live in Joplin, but Wicked Springfield, the city where it took place. But I still kind of wasn't really ready to let go of it because it just, you know, I just felt like it deserved more than just a short story or just a, you know, short article or a chapter in a book. I felt like it deserved a full treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. So part of what makes this story so interesting is that it centers around someone who was very well known in the 1880s, a woman named Emma Molloy. Again, someone that most people don't know about now, but in her day, very famous. Could you talk about her? Why was she so recognizable?
Yes, Emma Molloy was, she was born in South Bend, Indiana, and grew up there, and she was a bright girl. She's also very religious. She grew up in the Methodist Church. She ended up marrying a guy named Pratt, P-R-A-D-D-T, who was a printer. That she was just not quite 19 years old when they got married. They moved to Wisconsin, and he was, an alcoholic, and I don't know that he was abusive physically, but probably abusive emotionally. And their first child died when he was just like the girl, I guess it was, when she was just a year or two old. And then just a year or so after that, their second child died. So both of their children died. He took to drink to try to drown his sorrows, and that kind of, I guess, was the last straw, because he reverted, went off the wagon and started drinking again. And she divorced him and moved back to Indiana and married an editor of a newspaper, Ed Molloy. And he kind of treated her as an equal, took her into his publishing endeavors. And she was the co-publisher and editor of the local newspaper. They ran actually two or three different newspapers, but she was praised for her literary bent. And she was, at first it was kind of seen as a novelty that they had a woman in the journalism business. But pretty soon she kind of earned the respect of her fellow journalists. And then about 1870, the women's movement was kind of getting started, like Susan B. Anthony and others, and Emma Molloy kind of took it upon herself to embark on a speaking tour in favor of women's rights. Then not too long after that, she also took up the cause of temperance, and that's what she really got famous for, was her work and her speaking as a temperance speaker. She became first kind of known mainly in Indiana, but then she became nationally known and even internationally. She even made a trip to London and was very well received there. And as you say, at one point she was kind of maybe the if not the one of the two or three preeminent female orators in the country during the late 1870s, early 1880s, around in there. But anyway, another thing she got interested in, she kind of, it was kind of ironic, you know, that she was so opposed to alcohol, but she was involved in what today would be called progressive or liberal causes. Like another cause that she was involved in was prison reform. And she visited the North Indiana State Prison and made the acquaintance of a guy named George Graham, who was serving his second term in the Indiana State Prison North. He had been in prison once before for horse theft, and then he was serving a second term for forgery. But anyway, she kind of befriended him, and when he got out of prison, she kind of took him under her wing and took him into her publishing endeavors. At that time, by then, she was publishing she was the editor or publisher of a temperance magazine or newspaper called The Morning and Day of Reform, and she took him as her manager. And of course, that kind of, she started receiving a lot of criticism for that. But anyway, Graham did not tell her his whole background. He told her that he had been in prison once before, so she knew he had been in prison twice. What he did not tell her was he had been in prison three times. He had also been in prison in the Illinois prison once for horse theft before he got sent to prison in Indiana for horse theft. And he was, from the time he was just a preteen, he was in trouble in his hometown of Fort Wayne. He grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he was, in going back and researching some of the early Fort Wayne newspapers and records and stuff, he was mentioned a lot as just kind of a scoundrel, you know, even from the time he was just a teenager, I guess.
She's this very genteel, put-together woman. She's articulate, very respected in the Christian community, and a lot of heads turn when she not only befriends him, but employs him, right?
Right, yeah. Of course, she had already kind of started to incur a little bit of heads turning, you might say, because she had been divorced twice. She was divorced the first time from from Pratt, and then about the time that she made Graham's acquaintance somewhere right around in there, she also ended up divorcing Malloy. She still went by the last name Malloy, but she had actually, by the time the Springfield incident, you know, that the book is mainly about happened, she had been divorced from Malloy for a couple of years also. So that also, back in those days, of course, it was just unheard of for a woman to be divorced twice, you know, even once was not very often, but even was twice, it was unheard of. And so she was kind of frowned upon because of that. But yes, you're right that she was very well educated, very genteel, well spoken. And even though, despite the divorces and so forth, she still was very prominent and very well liked in the, especially in the temperance movement, within the temperance movement, because she was such an eloquent speaker. You know, everywhere she went, there were people would take the pledge, you know, not to drink. And she also got into evangelism a little bit, you know, and she was even saving souls.
Yeah, a really fascinating woman. So what was it about this relationship? What did she see in him that others didn't seem to?
Well, this I'm speculating really, but I think she was drawn to the fact that he was intelligent. I mean, he was a con man, but he was also, you know, literate and intelligent. And you can see that in the letters that even after he was arrested, he wrote letters to the Springfield newspapers, and they were pretty literate letters. You know, he would make literary allusions to Dickens and to various well-known authors in literature, and he used big words, you know, that you know, sometimes he used words that I even had to look up myself to see what they meant, you know. So he was an intelligent guy, but he was also a kind of a con man. And I think she just kind of she was a sucker for anybody that she thought she could save or thought she could, you know, redeem. But she particularly, I think, liked him because they were kind of intellectual matches, I believe. And so she took him, like I say, under her wing and employed him in her publishing the Morning and Day of Reform, which was a temperance newspaper. And they moved to Washington, Kansas, which is a small town in northern Kansas, kind of northwest of Topeka. And they kind of first started, I guess, people questioning the relationship between her and Graham, and why she was employing him and so forth, mainly there in Washington. And she kind of developed a few enemies, a few people, like you said a while ago, who were kind of looking askance at her and wondering what was going on. But she had a foster daughter named Cora Lee, with whom Graham started kind of falling in love and didn't openly court her, supposedly anyway, because at the time, his first wife, Sarah Graham, and their two children, two young sons, were actually living with the Malloy family in Washington. There was all like seven or eight people all living in the same home. In addition to Cora Lee, Emma Malloy also had a second foster daughter who was Cora's younger sister, Emma Lee. And then she had an adopted daughter, Etta Malloy. And then she had the only biological child of hers that was survived, and that was Frank Malloy, her and Ed's only son. So like I say, there was about seven or eight people all living in the same house. But somewhere around early part of 1885, Sarah and George had a falling out, and Sarah took the kids and went back to Fort Wayne. And it was about shortly after that when Emma Malloy came to Springfield, Missouri for her series of revivals. And that's where all the main heart of the book is about, is what happened after they got to Springfield.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's not a typical criminal, I guess. There were plenty of cads, ne'er-do-wells like him around. But what makes him kind of unique is that he was able to move around between two worlds. Would you say that? He was comfortable around common criminals, but he was also able to rub shoulders with educated people.
Yes, I think that's very accurate. I mean, even back in Fort Wayne, when he was in prison, I don't remember for sure whether it was the first time or the second time. I think maybe it was the first time. Yeah, when he was in prison, he studied law while he was in prison, and he came back to Fort Wayne and actually, you know, hung out a shingle as a lawyer. So, yeah, he was intelligent. And in fact, he also became a constable in between his stretches in prison, became a constable and became an advocate for temperance. And that's, I guess, another thing that that drew Emma to him is he had already kind of been involved in the temperance movement even before she met him. You know, he had become involved in that in between his prison stints.
So why Springfield?
The way she found her way there, well, of course, she went all over the country, and as I said, even sometimes traveled internationally at least a time or two. But she was brought to Springfield by Judge James Baker and some other prominent citizens of Springfield. Judge Baker had been instrumental back in the early 1870s of bringing the first railroad to Springfield, and he was a high up guy in the state of Missouri legal system. And so he was a very prominent person. And he was also a prohibitionist like Emma was. In fact, they had a very similar background politically. They both started out as Democrats, converted to or changed to Republicans, and then eventually became prohibitionists. And so his friendship, he very quickly developed a friendship with Emma, and she conducted a series of revivals in May and into early June of 1865 in Springfield. And after they were over, he offered to kind of set her up on a farm out just outside Springfield, between Springfield and the small town of Brookline, about 3 miles from Brookline, about 5 miles from Springfield. And he basically bought the house, the farm for her, and then she was going to pay him back in installments, that type of thing. Also, in the meantime, about the time that this farm transaction took place, Cora Lee, the older foster daughter, and George Grant. George came to Springfield, even though his wife and his kids had gone back to Fort Wayne. He didn't actually come with Emma Malloy and Cora Lee, but he showed up shortly afterwards, just a couple of weeks after they had gotten in Springfield, and resumed the courtship that he had undertaken back in Washington, Kansas, while he was still living with Sarah. And so they ended up getting married in July of 1885. And what the deal was is they knew that he was, of course, married to Sarah, because they actually even lived together. But he said he supposedly confessed to them that they had been living in sin, because he had divorced Sarah after he got out of prison the first time in Indiana, apologized, you know, and sought their forgiveness and so forth. And Mrs. Malloy checked up. She went and checked in the Indiana records, you know, sent a letter checking up, and come to find out, yes, sure enough, he had divorced Sarah. So she went ahead and gave the marriage her blessing. But what George had not told them was that he had remarried Sarah after he got out the first time, but before he went back the second time to prison. So he was still married to Sarah when he married Cora Lee.
This book is such a soap opera. Perhaps I'm getting ahead here, but this was a scandal that would rival any one of the modern celebrity era scandals easily.
Yes. It was so scandalous, you know, partly because of who, like you said earlier, you know, because of Emma Malloy's fame. You know, she was such a well-known person, and it really delighted the liquor people, you know, the anti-temperance people, that she was in trouble, because she was a strong advocate for temperance, and they were glad to see her kind of be brought down, you know. And so you know, it's always, I guess, a scandal when someone who sets themselves up as kind of a beacon of morality or whatever gets brought down, you know, and that's kind of what they were, you know, they were really enjoyed seeing that. But anyway, what happened then in the late summer, early fall of 1885 was Sarah started writing letters to George wanting to get back together, you know, and she finally said that she was going to come to Springfield and bring the boys. And he was trying to talk her out of it, but she insisted on that she was going to do it. So he finally agreed to meet her in St. Louis with the boys. And of course, he was still telling Sarah that he and Cora were not married, she had heard through the grapevine somehow that he had married Cora. And he was trying to convince his first wife that he had not married Cora, but he agreed to meet her in St. Louis. and this was like in late September of 1885. And they did meet in St. Louis. And again, he tried to talk her out of continuing the journey, tried to get her to go stay with an uncle who lived in St. Louis, or to go back to Fort Wayne or whatever. But she insisted on coming on. So they had the two kids with them. They came on to Springfield. And when they got to Springfield, George had already called ahead and made arrangements to have the two kids stay in a boarding house. And then he and Sarah were going to continue on out to Brookline. At least that's what they told the kids, you know. But what happened was that they eventually, you know, Sarah was so insistent that she was going to go on out to Brookline, and what she said, clear Cora out, that they started walking from Springfield to Brookline, which was about five miles away. And what happened exactly after that, no one really still probably knows for sure, but apparently from George's later confession and from what the investigators were able to determine, they got clear out almost to the farm, and she still would not turn back. And so he apparently killed her right just outside the farm and dumped her body in an old abandoned well there on the Malloy farm. And this was like September 30th or early in the morning of October 1st, 1885.
And according to his account, he would claim it was an accident, right?
Right. He claimed that they got into an argument about her sexual indiscretion, supposedly. She was, of course, giving him all kinds of heck for what he had done, you know, marrying Cora while he was still married to Sarah. And so he reminded her of some little indiscretion that she had done back in Indiana, I guess it was, or it may have been when they were living up by Chicago at Elgin, Illinois. And that supposedly made her mad, and she picked up had a stick in her hand or something that she was going to hit him with. I guess maybe she had a knife or something. I don't know. He had a knife in his hand while he was whittling. And anyway, he supposedly, according to her, accidentally stabbed her the first time, but he saw that she was injured so bad that he just went ahead and killed her. That was what he said in his confession when he finally did confess. Of course, it took him a long time before he finally confessed. You know, when he was first arrested, he, you know, denied anything about it. Well, actually, should kind of back up, because there were several months elapsed from the time that her body was dumped in the well before it was actually found. And that is a big part of the story, too, the hunt for what happened to her.
She was stabbed in the throat, correct?
Yes, stabbed. She was, of course, the coroner's inquest concluded that she had been killed by a gunshot. But he claimed that he did not shoot her. He claimed that he just stabbed her. They never did find a bullet. So, you know, in that sense, his story might have had some credence, but the so-called experts at the time all concluded that she had been shot, you know, even though they never actually found a bullet.
But he had dragged her to an abandoned well at the corner of the property, right? And just dumped her body in.
Just dumped her in, basically, yeah, and dumped in some of her belongings and so forth. And then this was, like I say, first part of October of 1885. And then by around Christmas, her father, Marquis Gorham from Fort Wayne, started writing, and her sister Abby started writing letters trying to find out what had happened to her, because she had promised Abby, her sister, that when she got to Springfield that she would write and let her know what was going on and so forth. And she didn't, and so they started writing letters inquiring what was going on and where she was. And the constable from Brookline tried to go out and search the premises, but they more or less wouldn't let him. They just said, no, you know, you don't have any right to come looking around. But they did kind of let him look around a little bit. And eventually in February, it took all the way to February, late February of 1886, when they finally organized a really determined search party. And they went out on that morning, I think it was February 25th, and they even had a windlass with them, because they'd already decided that might be one likely place that she was. So they had a windlass to enable them to lower a man down into the well. And that's what they did. And they discovered her body there at the bottom of the well, her decaying body. So it was clear that she had been there for quite some time. And John Potter, who was the postmaster at Brookline, also part of the search party, and he also had been one of the main ones trying to investigate where Sarah's whereabouts were. And he rushed to Springfield to report what had happened. And then the authorities came out to the farm, and George was arrested. He wasn't arrested immediately because he wasn't present. He had taken off. Again, I need to backtrack a little bit, because when things started closing in on him, when he realized that, that they were really intent on finding Sarah, he forged some checks in Springfield and used the money to finance his getaway. And he took off for Kansas City and St. Joseph, Missouri. And Emma tried to, get him to come back. She said, you look more guilty by running than you would if you come back and face the music, because she still believed in him at this time. She still thought he was innocent. And so she finally talked him into coming back, and she made his checks good. His bad checks that he had written, she made them good. And then it was shortly after that that the public found out that he was a bigamist. Even up until this point, they had not even known he was a bigamist, much less a murderer, but they found out that he had been previously married to Sarah and had gotten remarried to her and had not gotten divorced a second time. So it came out in the Springfield newspapers first that he was a forger. And then a couple of weeks later, it came out that he was a bigamist. And then not too long after that, they discovered Sarah's body. And so then they were pretty sure he was also a murderer, so he finally did come back, and they arrested him and put him in jail for suspicion of murder.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906. When a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the Golden Age of Piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Graham was such a professional liar. I mean, he had all these people believing in him, covering for him, even as the walls were closing in. His children were even covering for him. They knew their mother had come all the way to Springfield, of course. I mean, they traveled with her. and he told them not to tell his new family. And after he's murdered Sarah, he introduces his children to his new wife. And the way he's able to manipulate Emma Molloy is really astounding.
Oh yes, he was a very good liar. You know, if he'd get caught in one lie, he would just fall back on another one. You know, like he first said that Sarah had gone on to Kansas City or something. You know, and he said he had met her in a hotel room up there in a certain room. So one of the detectives went up to Kansas City to check to see if he actually had, and they found out, of course, that he had not. But then he had another lie ready. I can't remember, but he would always have another lie handy, you know, as soon as he got caught in one lie, you know. And as you say, he was very manipulative. He even told Charlie, his oldest son, who was 13 years old, as you said, he told Charlie that his mother was actually staying in a nearby town called Pierce City. And the reason that she had not gone on out to the farm was George said he needed to get some things settled, but he was going to inherit or get all of the farm for himself. And when that happened, then he would bring the family there. But in the meantime, he did not want Sarah coming there to the farm because it would upset Cora and Emma, you know, because they didn't like each other. And, you know, but he was just lying to his own kids about it, you know.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I just want to make sure I get the timeline right. So he's arrested, but authorities just assume that he didn't act alone in all of this. They didn't believe his new wife or Emma Molloy could have been blind to his machinations. And possibly they were involved in the murder or the planning of the murder as well.
Right. Emma Molloy was not really suspected of being in on the actual murder because she was off on one of her evangelic meetings, you know, or her temperance meetings, but they thought she was in on covering it up, you know, and she did try to protect him. There's no doubt that she did try to protect him, but what was she trying to protect him from? You know, I kind of argue in the book that she was just trying to protect him from what she saw as a rush to judgment, because at this point she still believed he was innocent. You know, she had, you know, he just had her convinced that he did not do this, you know, and it was just, you know, it's almost unbelievable that she could have been that naive. But I really truly think she was so insisting on kind of saving his soul or whatever that she just was blind to his faults. But yeah, they arrested him for murder, but they ended up arresting both Cora and Emma Molloy. Cora Lee and Emma Molloy as accessories, Cora as an accessory before the fact and Emma Molloy as an accessory after the fact. And their preliminary hearings took place before his preliminary hearing, even though he was the one that was actually charged with murder. They went ahead and held the women's preliminary hearing first. And that was the legal proceeding that the 1915 Greene County history referred to as the most spectacular procedure in the entire life of the county.
And part of what was going on was that there were rumors that there was an intimate relationship between them. Neither would admit to, at least initially for Graham.
Yes, and that started really at the preliminary hearing, because Charlie Graham, the 13-year-old son, was the main witness, the main prosecution witness, and he not only, you know, he really didn't have any firsthand knowledge as far as the murder was concerned, but he did implicate Emma Molloy in a kind of a sexual liaison with his father. He didn't specifically say that he had seen him having sex or anything like that, but he'd seen him in compromising positions, you know, like he'd seen his father sitting on her lap or vice versa, her sitting on his father's lap and such as that, you know. And so it was really a kind of a scandalous thing. His testimony was, you know, very highly, highly charged, and a lot of people, the courthouse was just flooded with people, you know, because of wanting to hear all the gossip, you know, on Emma Molloy.
And of course, again, it's even more sensational, I guess, because she's the leader of a Christian movement, and the rumors of scandals just stack on top of each other.
Yeah.
She's involved with the same man her foster daughter is, and this man was married to someone else. And she doesn't do well handling all of these innuendos, right?
Right. Well, she waited too long to answer, I guess. But that, you know, a lot of that was, at least that was what people criticized her for. She waited too long to deny all this. And, but she said the reason she was, and it got kind of makes sense, is she was trying to get proof that this all was wrong. Well, I should go ahead and say that, it got even worse than what her, the son, Charlie Graham, testifying against her. But because after they denounced his testimony, then George went one step further and issued an inflammatory statement, big, long statement about all the places that he had, in fact, actually had sexual relations with Emma Molloy, even named hotels and places and times and such as that. And so she said the reason that she did not promptly answer that was she was digging up the proof that she could not have been in some of the places that he said she was, you know, and she was having to solicit letters from people who knew and that sort of thing. So that's why she did promptly deny it, but she didn't offer any convincing proof. And, you know, she just said it took time to dig up all the evidence. So that was, wasn't really a mistake on her part, but it was just something that caused people to suspect her even more, I guess.
Do you believe that they were having an intimate relationship?
I do not. But for one thing, I think one of the strongest arguments against it is the fact that she and Cora remained close throughout this whole thing. You know, I just can't imagine a young woman whose foster mother was having sex with her husband-to-be and husband at the same time that he supposedly was telling Cora that he loved only her, you know, and that if there's any truth to it, that Cora would have continued to have been friends and continued to look at Emma Molloy as her mother, which, and she did, you know, she never turned against Emma. I mean, there's other reasons why I believe it also, but that's one of the main reasons. But when Emma finally did offer proof of some of the things that, places where she has supposedly had been, according to George, she offered proof that she had not. And I was even able to go back into newspapers and prove for myself that she actually was where she said she was at the time. You know, like in one case, it was in Ohio somewhere. I can't remember where George said she was on the October the 8th of 1884 or something like that. 1883, I guess it was October 8th of 1883, that he supposedly met her and had a sexual relationship with her in a certain town in Ohio. And it was 50 miles away from the town where Emma actually was, where she spent the night. And she was with other people who verified her, you know, that she was there the whole time in that town, not in the town that George said he was. And I looked back in the newspapers and I found that, yes, indeed, she was in that town where she said she was, you know. And that's just one example. But, you know, it's like one of the observers at the time pointed out, if Graham was lying about one particular instance, he probably was lying about the whole thing, you know, so because he was such a known liar anyway.
So she really only turned on him when he finally turned on her, when he felt he was backed against the wall. And it took that for her to realize the true nature of his immoral character.
Yeah, she didn't turn on him until, like you say, until it was just obvious to everybody by then that he was guilty. And she finally had to kind of accept the handwriting on the wall because one thing, he kind of started turning on her when she wouldn't go his bail to try to get him out of jail. You know, she said that she didn't have the money right then, that she had, there's no way she could come up with that kind of money, you know, and he, that kind of started turning him against her. But she still believed, even at that point, she still believed he was innocent. And it wasn't until later that she finally kind of realized that she had been played for a fool.
What were the results of the preliminary hearings?
Well, at the end of the preliminary hearing, Cora was indicted and held for, well, she wasn't indicted. She was held for the grand jury on the charges of accessory before the fact, and Emma Molloy was held on charges of accessory after the fact, and then the grand jury did go ahead and indict both of them. But then before it actually went to trial or anything, and before Graham himself even had his preliminary hearing, he ended up getting lynched.
If you could walk us through that lynching, did he see that coming? I mean, there had been a buzz around town, not only that he might get lynched, but that Emma and Cora might as well.
Right. There was especially strong with him. But yeah, like you say, there were even rumors that the two women might get lynched. But especially from the time he was first arrested, there were, especially from around the little community of Brookline where the murder took place, there were people who had written to the authorities in Greene County saying that you need to hurry up and have a speedy trial on this and quit delaying justice and everything. And then if you don't, we'll take things into our own hand. And eventually that's what they did. What instigated it was Graham's lawyer was trying to get him released on bond or something. And when that happened, it's the very next day is when he was lynched. It was in late April of 1885. They took him out, a whole bunch of men, but there were like 10 of them that actually went into the Greene County jail there in Springfield and forced their way into the cell and took him out. And they took him about 2 or 3 miles north of the square. The square, of course, is where the courthouse was, and the jail was on the backside of the courthouse, and took him to what's now a park called Grant Beach Park. I don't think it was there. Well, I know it was not there at the time, but anyway, they took him to that place and lynched him. And, you know, I don't think anybody really thought that they had the wrong person. You know, they all felt like that he had confessed. In fact, he had actually even confessed to the murder. He just wouldn't backtrack on his sexual innuendos about the women, but he did take all the blame as far as the murder itself was concerned.
And the lynching was botched too, right? It's like he wasn't high enough.
Yeah, the first time they tried to lynch him, like you say, it wasn't high enough, and his feet touched the ground, so they had to take off the rope and put it up higher and redo it. And this was like 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning or something when it happened. And there was rumors even, of course, some people claimed that Judge Baker, you know, Emma's powerful friend and his friends were even kind of instigated the whole deal in order to shut him up, you know, so he wouldn't further implicate the two women in the murder itself. But the evidence, most of the evidence points pretty clearly to the fact that the lynch mob came from Brookline, not from Springfield. You know, Baker's influence was mainly in Springfield. That's where he was a prominent person. He wasn't well known in Brookline. It was all mainly Brookline people that came in and lynched him.
And they left a rather ominous note pinned to his clothing.
Yeah. Yeah, they called themselves the 300, I think it was, and they said that anybody who tries to discover the actors in this drama or something like that, you know, will be consigned to hell or something. I don't know, you know, it was kind of a colorful wording the way they worded it. I don't remember exactly what it was, but without looking it up, but yeah, it was kind of a ominous and it's colorful and like you say, ominous note that was attached to his body.
So what happened after the lynching?
It was after George got lynched that Emma finally issued her denial. And she got a lot of criticism for that too, you know, saying that, why didn't she issue her denial while he was still alive to answer it? Well, my contention is, you know, how did she know when he was going to get lynched? You know, unless you really believe the contention that that James Baker had something to do with it. I don't. So anyway, as I said, she was just taking time to get evidence to prove that she was not with him in Chicago and these various other places. But anyway, Cora's trial was held first before Emma's, and it kept getting postponed. And it was finally held in the summer of 1887, or maybe it was the spring of 1887, and it ended in a hung jury. And then she was tried again a second time a year later in early 1888. And in the second trial, she was acquitted real quickly. I don't remember if it was unanimous. I can't remember right offhand whether it was a unanimous verdict or not. I'd have to look that up. But anyway, there was no doubt in the minds of those jurors that she was innocent. And after that happened, then the charges against Emma Molloy were dropped. But the taint of scandal still lingered. You know, she was never quite the famous temperance orator that she had been before all this happened. She did move out to the state of Washington and kind of reestablished herself there as a working in the temperance movement and working at the Siemens Bethel, ministering to sailors. But she was never nationally famous like she had been before.
Yeah, later on in her life, there would be new figures taking up the temperance mantle, like Carrie Nation, who used a bit more of an aggressive strategy, right?
Yeah, more aggressive, and I don't really know that much about Carrie Nation, but I doubt very seriously if she was as eloquent a speaker as Emma Molloy. A lot of people said that, just being her presence, it was like you were drawn into the influence of her. She's almost mesmerizing, you know, that she was just had that effect on people, you know, that she was just a mesmerizing person, mesmerizing speaker, you know.
You can see, even from the illustrations, the photographs of her, there is something very alluring about her.
Yeah, well, yeah, she's attractive. I mean, she was an attractive woman, you know. She got a thing I haven't touched on was before the George Graham scandal, she also got involved in a little bit of a scandal in 1882 when a fellow temperance worker left his wife to pursue Emma and went chasing after Emma Molloy. And they, you know, accused her of egging him on, you know, of enticing him. But then they had conducted a hearing into it, inquiry into it, and they completely exonerated her. And he even admitted that she'd had nothing to do with it, that he just decided he wanted to try to go after her because, you know, and one of the newspapers commented that Emma Molloy should know that there's always going to be foolish men pursuing attractive women, you know, and she was an attractive woman. You know,
he probably turned to drink after that, huh?
Well, he actually became a sworn enemy of hers and started writing letters against her and so forth. But then by the time of the big scandal in Springfield, he had started writing letters again, trying to get back with her. I mean, as a friend, you know, to get back into her good graces. So, and he had reconciled with his wife, and he even said that his wife was willing to become friends with her again, you know.
So what about the Graham boys? They wanted some modicum of revenge for the death of their mother.
I think they did, especially at the very beginning. But I really think that by the end of it, by the time Cora was exonerated, or Cora was found not guilty in 1888, Charlie had kind of come around and started changing his mind and realizing that his father really was the probably the only guilty one. He offered a testimony at the second trial that he had not offered at the first trial, which kind of assured that she would get off, when he said that he had previously said that his father did not have a pistol with him in St. Louis, that he had left his pistol with Cora. And so they thought that Mate Cora might have even been the one that pulled the trigger, you know. But at the second trial, Charlie admitted that, yes, his father did have a pistol in St. Louis before they ever came to Springfield, you know. So that kind of showed that maybe Cora was not the one that had anything to do with pulling the trigger, you know.
So is there anything left physically from the scene of the crime? I mean, if someone went out to visit the farm, what would they find?
The farm is still fairly much intact, which it actually surprised me when I was first started trying to look for it. I thought it, because the whole area around it has been built up and, you know, it's pretty much a housing addition, but the actual farm where this took place is still pretty much intact, and it's surrounded by all these housing areas. But really the only thing there that resembles probably the way it was at the time is the lay of the land. You know, you can still recognize where they talk about the well into which Sarah's body was tossed is kind of down at the bottom of the hill. And it's, you know, you can still see that hill where the bottom of the hill where it took place. And the farmhouse itself is not there. It's not the same one. Or if it is the same one, it's been drastically remodeled. I haven't really tried to find out for sure whether it's the same one. I'm just assuming it's not. But it is located in pretty much the same place. But like I say, even if it is the same one underneath, it's not the same one, same exterior or anything like that.
When you went to visit the premises, was the family living there surprised at its history?
Actually, the place was for sale at the time, and I called the number on the, you know, the for sale sign, and I talked to the owner, and I asked him, you know, if he had ever heard anything about it, and he said no, you know, he didn't even know anything about it, you know, but he was in the process of selling it, and that's why I thought when he sold it that it might get chopped up into, you know, parceled into lots, but it's not. It's still pretty much intact farm. This has been a couple of years ago that I talked to him, and he was in the process of selling it then, so it has since sold, and there's no indication that it's going to be chopped up into a housing addition.
And as far as you know, that the family that lives there now has no idea what happened there.
No, as far as I know, they do not. I have not talked to them. But, you know, as far as what happened to any of the family members and stuff, George and Roy, his little brother, they went back with Abby, Sarah's sister, their aunt, their aunt, and as we say in the Ozarks, instead of aunt. But anyway, they went back to Fort Wayne with her and were kind of reared by her. And as far as I can tell, they, or at least Charlie, kind of just grew up to be a normal person, you know, pretty law-abiding person. I found him in later census records and stuff. And I don't think he inherited his father's scandalous ways or his ruffian ways or whatever you want to call it.
Did Cora Lee remarry?
Cora Lee did finally remarry. She, not for quite a while, but yeah, she remarried and lived with her sister in Omaha, Nebraska for a while, and then finally moved out to Wyoming, I think. And yeah, she lived up into the like 1920s or 30s, somewhere around there, I think. Of course, Emma died shortly after the turn of the century, right around not too long after the turn of the century.
So for people who want to learn more about you and your work, you have a blog, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's www.ozarks-history@blogspot.com.
Perfect. And what will people find there?
It's mostly going to be about local regional history, anything about Southwest Missouri, Southeast Kansas, Northwest Arkansas, the whole state of Missouri, actually, and even Northeast Oklahoma, including this book even. That's mainly what I write about, is stuff that has happened in the four-state, what we call the four-state area of Kansas, Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. And I write about two things, either the Civil War. I've written several books about the Civil War, and then most of the rest of the stuff I write is about notorious stuff, you know, gunfights and murders and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we like that stuff here.
Yeah, I do too. I enjoy researching it.
Yeah, so when was your book released?
It was released on the 15th of this month, and of course it's available through Kent State University, their website, or it's available to other stores, online stores, that sort of thing.
Perfect. Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you for spending some time with me.
Thanks, Eric.
Again, I have been speaking to Larry Wood, and we've been talking about his book, Bigamy and Bloodshed, The Scandal of Emma Molloy and the Murder of Sarah Graham. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobweb corner of the world. I'm Eric Rimenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.